Good morning. I want you to know what an honor it is for me to stand in your presence. How many of you have not heard me speak before? Raise your hand. Well, have fun. If I was talking to you one-on-one, first thing I'd do is find out what books have you read. What trainings have you taken? What words and concepts are you familiar with as you explore this idea of being God in form? Then after asking you those kinds of questions, we could do this whole talk based on the words you're familiar with, the concepts you're used to. But since my people were all Montana people and I got a little country in me, there's a good chance as I get on a roll this morning, I might say something a little different than you're used to. I might tell a story a little different. Quote scripture, do something that's just a little different. And all I would ask is that if we run into a place where there's a little difference, please look past it. Because I guarantee you my sole intention this morning is to remind each of us how absolutely magnificent and powerful we are right now. Now with that said, when I come to a church the first time, or whether there's this many people who haven't heard me before, I always tell a little, how did I get into this philosophy that we call unity, what I call the practical applications of the teachings of Jesus. When I was 23, I hurt my back. I was working construction between college semesters. A year later, I had a spinal fusion. Somehow during surgery, my spine got infected with the E. coli bacteria. E. coli is a bad bug, and this was 45 years ago. So with E. coli, there's not a good antibiotic, so they just have to cut it out. So that orthopedic surgeon over the next year did 4 surgeries to get rid of the infection, and every time he went in, it was worse. So finally, after the last one, when I came out of the recovery room, he just said, look, this is way out of my league. You need more than one primary care physician, so I've referred you to the University of Washington Medical Center in Seattle. That's where I lived. He says, that's a teaching hospital. They got all the people you need under one roof. So I went in there, and I became a celebrity within a couple of days. It turned out I had the worst case of osteomyelitis of the spine, an infection of the bone I'd ever seen. So my doctor became this visiting professor from England. He was supposed to be the number 3 orthopedic surgeon in the whole world. The other professors didn't talk like that, but the interns and residents did. This guy was kind of standoffish, and he said, look, with E. coli, there's not a good antibiotic, so I need to find out where this is in your body, and we're just going to go in and cut it out. And he said, I don't want to be blindsided during the surgery, so I want to do tests. So I said, oh, okay. So they did tests. For 2 weeks, they did tests. 14 days, all day, every day. They poked me in places I didn't even know I had places. Finally, he came in after they got some good x-rays, and when he came in that afternoon, he was different. I mean, I wasn't into feelings back then. I was in my 20s, and I was a construction worker. But but he was different. And he said, look, he said, we got some good x-rays. It's more invasive than I ever thought. So I want to have a meeting tomorrow with some other specialists. And then when we're done with the meeting, we'll come in and tell you what we're going to do. And then the next morning, we'll do this debridement. Okay. That afternoon when my wife came, the first thing she said when she walked into my room was, what happened? What do you mean? She said, what happened? Everybody's different. The nurses won't look me in the eye. Nobody said hello. They just sort of waved and, what happened? And I said, I don't know. So we talked. Next day they had this meeting. I mean, there's a lot of drama. Guy came in about 3 o'clock in the afternoon with a tray in his hand. He says, hi, my name's Frank, and I'm here to prep you. Prep is hospital jargon for shave. So I started to roll over so he could get to my back. And he said, you don't need to roll over. And I said, how come? And he says, because I got orders here to do a front and back end to end. I said, what's an end-to-end? He said, you've never had an end-to-end, have you? And I said, no. And he looked down and he says, I got orders here to shave you from your nipples to your knees, both front and back, and every place in between. And when he said that, I almost passed out, because they only shave where they're going to cut. My wife came a little while later. I showed her what they'd done. I thought I'd get some sympathy. She just giggled. Anyway, we waited. 5 o'clock came and went. Nobody showed up, which really surprised me, because my doctors were all professors. Usually professors go home at 5. 6 o'clock came and went. 7 o'clock came and went. 8:15, door to my private room opened up, and in walked six surgeons. And if there's good news, there's usually one person to tell you. And if it's bad news, they tell you by committee. These guys walked in. The guy in the lead was this orthopedic surgeon from England. Behind him was head of the Department of General Surgery. Behind him was the head of the Department of Infectious Disease. Behind those guys were the three top residents in those departments. And this is what they said. This infection has spread. It's throughout your spine. It's followed both of your sciatic nerves into your thighs. It's throughout your pelvic area. It's throughout your abdomen. It's eaten holes in your colon, because E. coli just eats things, so that the germs are communicating back and forth. And he looked at me and he said, Terry, if we don't stop this now, you will die. Well, he didn't say that. Doctors don't say that. What they say is, this has now become life-threatening, which means if we don't stop this now, you will die. So he said, tomorrow we're going to do the most extensive debridement we've ever attempted here. We're going to take you down to the operating theater, and first the general surgeons are going to start from the front. They're going to start as low as they can go down here in your pelvic area. We're going to come up around your belly button, go almost up your sternum. We're going to open all of that up. We're going to cut out all the infected tissue. We're going to separate your organs out of the way. And when we get onto the spine, the orthopedic surgeons will chisel and scrape the infection out of your spine. When we're done with that, we're going to roll you over, and the orthopedic surgeons are going to start from the back. They're going to start as low as they can go down here between your buttocks. We're going to come up mid-back. We're going to open all that up, cut out all the infected tissue, chisel and scrape the infection out of your spine. He went into a lot more detail than I'm giving you. He said, when we're done with that, two teams of surgeons are going to start at your belt line and open up both your buttocks and follow your sciatic nerves into your thigh. And when we're done with that, we're going to tip you up on the end and come in from the bottom, because it's completely engulfed the lower end of your spinal column. He got about 5 minutes into that thing, and I just started shaking. My wife came and held me on one side. The head nurse came and held me on the other side. And I just shook and listened to him. Finally, he sat down on a chair and pulled it up next to my bed, and he reached out and took my hand. And that's when I knew I was in trouble, because this guy was not a touchy-feely doctor. And he said, son, I know how radical this must seem, but we have to do this. When we're done with this debridement, the antibiotics that we do have in the drains, we're pretty sure we can stop this infection from spreading anymore. The bad news is that we're pretty sure you're going to lose the use of your left leg through nerve damage. And then he just looked at me. And I just looked at him. And he just looked at me. And I just looked at him. And finally, I figured it must be my turn to say something. And I heard come out of my own mouth, that's okay. That's okay. If we've got to do this, let's just get it over with. But even as I heard those words come out of my mouth, I thought, what has happened to me? What has happened to me that in just 1 year I would so willingly give up the use of my left leg? But I no sooner said that than he reached up with his other hand, clamped mine between his, and he said, son, we have to do this. The bad news is if it's as extensive as we think it is, there's a good chance you're going to lose some of the mobility of your right leg. You're probably going to lose the control of your bowels and your bladder, and there's a good chance you're going to end up sexually impotent. That was just before my 24th birthday. When they left, the resident who had been with me for the 2 weeks of tests sat on my bed with my wife, and he just held me. He didn't say anything. He just held me. And when I calmed down, he said, "We don't know what's going to happen, Terry. We've never seen anything like this. But what we do know is you cannot expect to come out of this one whole." The name of my book is The Hell I Can't. I invite you this morning to get underneath the words that I use. Get underneath the concepts. Because when I talk to you about your absolute authority on this physical plane to be able to create the reality that you want, this isn't smoke and mirrors with me. They went in the next day, and when they opened up the pelvic area, they found the lower end of my colon was just perforated. They said there weren't any holes in it. It was like a sieve. So they pulled my bowels out, clipped them, sewed them to my abdomen, said, "You're going to go to the bathroom in a plastic bag the rest of your life." A month later, they did that big one. I was on the table for 13 and a half hours. Took 27 units of blood. And the reason they stopped after 13 and a half hours is they were losing me. I had an infection for 11 years. They did 27 major surgical procedures with a general anesthetic. I got letters from some of the finest doctors in the world to the insurance company, because I hurt my back on the job, so labor and industry was paying for everything. And after a couple surgeries, the insurance company wrote letters and said, "When are you going to fix this, kid?" And the doctors wrote letters back. I have letters from the finest doctors in the world that says what I have was not curable. They did things to my body a person is not supposed to recover from. A couple days ago, I turned 69 years old. I don't have a bad back. I'm not recovering from a bad back. I haven't learned to live within my human limitations, and I took the prayer they gave me that said I needed to accept the things I could not change and put it in the trash and put a new one up that said all things are possible if only I believe. I have no pain, no residual effect, nothing. When I talk to you about these spiritual principles within unity, this is not smoke and mirrors. You can learn to take charge of your creative mind and thereby learn to create reality instead of face reality. But this morning, I'm not going to talk about how to use these principles to heal disease, which you certainly can. What I want to talk about this morning is the mystical history of unity. I want to talk about how these great spiritual principles that have been around for thousands and thousands of years and sort of weave them through into the what we call today unity. Now know that this is just going to be a brief synopsis of the mystical history. There have been thousands of books written on the mysticism. My focus, as I have studied over the years, has always been about how do you grow corn with this stuff. I was never really interested in do some stuff and when you die you go to a better place. You know, and that's not what Jesus said. Jesus wasn't talking about do this and when you die you go to heaven. What he said was, "Behold, the kingdom of heaven is at hand." So my focus has always been, how do these teachings relate to me and how I can move into my life and be the creator of my life? From my perspective, the oldest living religion is the Hindu faith. And one of the things I love about the Hindu faith is they start from the idea that everybody is different. And so within their spiritual traditions, they allow these differences of the individual to be addressed. At first when I studied the Hindu faith, it just was real confusing. They got a God for everything. But then as I began to study and understand, what they do is take this idea of the divine and they bring it down so that every individual can relate to it. They, if you're a farmer, they got a god, a statue of a god, whose sole purpose is to help you grow crops. So as a farmer, you can take your priorities and start to relate to God just so you can, you know, grow better crops. They got a god or a goddess that's just to help you have children. So if you're a woman and you want to start moving into having a family, they have a god that you can relate to as a woman just so you can, your specific priorities. But as you move up these various aspects of the one God within the Hindu faith, you can move up to the mystical teachings within Hinduism. But you couldn't study those mystical teachings unless you were in the right caste system. You couldn't study the mystical teachings unless you'd gone through all the initiations before and knew all the secret handshakes and, you know, all that stuff. And you certainly couldn't study the mystical aspects of Hinduism if you were a woman. You had to be a male. But if you could go study the mystical teachings, this is what you began to be exposed to. It's out of a book called The Magic and Mysticism of India. The Hindu teachings hold that the universe is controlled by a universal mental principle, which is known as creative mind. The essence and elementary character of this creative mind is sort of like a blending or a combination of one's personal will and their imagination, and that each individual is possessed of a portion of this creative mind. I mean, we have that in Unity. The mind of God is my mind. You know, that kind of thing. But then they go on and they say this: in the Hindu teachings, it is held that the mind, when disciplined enough, has the power of creating material representations in and of itself without the need for physical activity. In other words, what they move into is all things are possible if only you believe. And they go on and they say, this achievement, this ability to demonstrate your mental power is to be part of our mental inheritance and can be used when we discipline ourselves sufficiently to make use of this God-like ability. So as you move up in the Hindu faith and start to study the mystical aspect, it can be confused because there's all the different ways to do it. All of these evolved disciplines are unique, and they have within all of the various, because within the Hindu faith there's all kinds of different specific traditions, but they all have what I call daily disciplined spiritual practices. Things that you do every day. We in Unity call affirmations. We talk about denial. We talk about, you know, those kinds of things. Every mystical tradition has within it daily disciplined spiritual practices. The confusing part is they're all different. This one says you got to do it this way. This one says you got to do it this way. But if you step back, you begin to understand that all of them talk about you taking charge of your creative mind. For me, in the lineage of this mystical history of Unity, the next one for me is the Jewish faith. It was started by a guy named Abraham, or Abram, depending on how you want to pronounce it. And he lived in a town where it was a trading center. There were all kinds of different religions and all kinds of different gods. And he woke up one day and said, no, there's only one God. Monotheistic. One God that does everything. And out of the Jewish, out of his teachings came what we call the 12 tribes of Israel. Like most religions, in the beginning, the Jewish faith start with all the rules. I think the Old Testament has 612 rules, that if you're going to get to heaven, if you're going to be a good person, you have to do this, and you have to do this, and you have to do this, and you have to do this. It's the same game we got today, they're just different rules. Today we have to hold our palms up so we can be receptive. We have to have our feet flat on the floor so the energy of Mother Earth flows up through us, eyes up to the left, remembering up to the right. But all faiths in the beginning start with these rules. But as you move through those rules, you can once again move up and begin to explore the mystical teachings of the Jewish faith. Usually those are embodied in the Kabbalah, the mystical side of Judaism. Now, once again, you couldn't go study those mystical teachings unless the Jews didn't have a caste system as such, but you couldn't go study those mystical teachings unless you could prove Jewish heritage on both sides of your family for five generations. You couldn't study those unless you'd gone through and jumped through the hoops and knew all the right handshakes and all that stuff before you could study the mystical stuff. And certainly, you couldn't study those mystical teachings unless you were a male. But if you could go study those mystical teachings, what you find is that they begin to talk about consciousness, about your intellect. There was a Jewish, Hebrew scholar back in the 1200s, Moses Ben Malman. And he wrote a book called The Guide for the Perplexed. I know this is kind of dry, but it gets to a really good point. So he wrote a book called The Guide for the Perplexed. It sounds like a book we could use today. He opens his book with this. He goes on to explain that let us make man in our image signifies not a physical likeness, but an intellectual likeness. He's not a Jewish scholar of the tradition and dogma of the Jewish faith. He's a Hebrew scholar. And what he's saying is the line in Scripture that says you and I were made in the image of God means it's an intellectual image. That the mind of God is my mind. The same idea that the Hindus have, that the universe is run by creative consciousness, and we each have a portion of that creative consciousness. So as you began to study the mystical side of Judaism, you began to understand that the similarity that you have with God is something to do about an intellectual similarity, a thinking portion, if you will. The words are kind of tough, but that's that idea, the mind of God is my mind. And in the Kabbalah, the whole purpose of the mystical side of Judaism is to heal the separation when we came into form. So that's that, we used to be one with God, and then we decided to come as a human being, and we separated ourselves from God. It's that fall from grace thing that's in all of the traditions. And the whole purpose of the Kabbalah is to teach a thing called kovana, K-O-V-A-N-A-H. And what it means is mystical intention in prayer. And you could use this mystical intention in prayer, but you could only use it to heal this fall from grace thing. But then along comes a guy named Isaac Luria. And he's one of the three most influential teachers in the history of the Kabbalah. But Luria brought something else to the party. In a book called The Major Trends in Jewish Mysticism, it says this: but the doctrine of mystical intention and prayer does not stop there for Luria. For he took the whole school of thought in classical Kabbalism and merely developed it further. And to Luria, the doctrine of mystical intention and prayer stands directly on the borderline between traditional mysticism, you could use it for your spiritual needs, and magic. Now, when they used the word magic thousands of years ago, they weren't talking sleight of hand. Magic was used when you created form, when you healed the sick, raised the dead, created food, the loaves and fishes, that kind of stuff. That was called magic. And what Luria did was he was one of the first big guns to say, no, these spiritual principles we're talking about, this idea of taking charge of your creative mind, is not just available for your spiritual needs, it's also available for your human needs. Now, when he brought that to the party, there was this huge brouhaha. Oh, no, you can't do this. It's the same game we play today. There's an infinite power in the universe, and you can use it for everything, but you can't use it for your ego-centered priorities. You can't do this with it. You can't do this with it, and you can't do this with it. It's the same game we wrestle with today. But Luria brought to the party, no, you can use this on your human needs and your human aspirations. But there was, like I said, this huge conflict. Around the time that Luria was bringing this to the party, what came into civilization, what's sometimes called the ancient mystery schools, the Essenes in the Middle East, the Druids in the United Kingdom area, the Magi in Persia, the school of Isis for women in Egypt. And like today, these different mystery schools, there were many different paths to understand your relationship to God. The Druids seemed to me to talk about, absorb this power and step forth. You know, it seemed kind of that kind of energy to me. The Essenes were a lot about meditation and ritual. The Magi were about how to use mind to create form. And that's where they got their name. The Magi is short for magic. And the ritual they used to be able to create form was their imagination. And if you take the word imagine and break it up, it's spelled I am a genie. I'm not saying this is absolutely the way it is. I'm saying that if you go and start to study these ancient mystical teachings, there is this thread of truth that you begin to see that runs through all of them. It's said in the various mystical writings that about 3,000 years ago, the leaders of all of these different faiths, if you will, knew that they were all talking the same stuff. It's that idea, many paths to one God. They knew that then. And what these leaders decided was it was time to take these secret teachings to the world. It wasn't fair just to have a select group of Jews or just a select group of Hindus or a select group of this who could study this. It was time to take these secret teachings to the world. And it is addressed in the various mystical writings about 3,000 years ago that a call went out to an ascended master. That's the label they used back in then. Look past the words. A call went out to an ascended master who was willing to come again and take these secret teachings to the world. And supposedly the birth of Jesus was that ancient master who was willing to come again. I'm not saying Jesus wasn't the only begotten son of a living God. I'm not saying he wasn't virgin born. I'm not doing any of that. I'm just saying that if you begin to explore these mystical writings, you will find that there is this idea about the power of the human mind, the power of your mind, the power of your consciousness, the power of your personal will, that you find this thread of truth that runs through all of them and culminates with the birth of Jesus. And in the original Greek writings of the Old Testament, because it was written first in Greek, the guys that come to visit Jesus at his birth are not called the three wise men. In the original Greek, they're called the masters of magi. And it is said that the reason these masters of magi came from three different places in Persia was that they were at Jesus' birth to signify that finally these secret teachings would be taken to the world. And then we move through the Christian traditions and, of course, move up into Myrtle Fillmore and Charles Fillmore and the founder of Unity. And where did it start? It started with Myrtle taking charge, if you will, t- taking charge of her creative mind and creating health where there was only disease. And out of her being able to demonstrate that, then Charles, who was an intellectual, you know, a real estate guy, he started studying these various principles and put together what we today call unity. That the mystical heritage of unity goes back thousands and thousands of years, that speaks to the power of one's creative mind. And that's what unity is about. It's about learning to apply these principles on a daily basis so you can take charge of your life. And it's not just use these principles to get a new car or a new home, and certainly you could do that. It's not just to use these principles to create health where there's only disease. What these principles are about is you being able to make your dreams come true. Your aspirations, your priorities. It's sort of like this. This is what I think Jesus brought to the party. When you use these principles on something that's important to you, and you know what I mean by principles, choice of destination, choice of action, choice of mental environment, choice of emotional environment, Thanksgiving, those are all universal mental principles that when you begin to weave them together, you can create reality. And the idea is, this is what Jesus was talking about when he said, faith without works is dead. Just thinking about this stuff isn't it. The real hunger is to prove it. And so when you use these principles on something that's important to you and it happens, you get feedback about the difference you made. And it doesn't have to be something really big. Do you remember the first time you created a parking place out of choice? My bet is you didn't go to a class. You just had a friend who always got a parking place on the way. And so then one, you said, how do you do that? And they said, well, before I get there, I go do my spiritual principles. If I'm at Science of Mind, we call it spiritual mind treatment. If I'm at Unity, we call it affirmative prayer. If I'm just talking to my friends, I call it woo-woo. And so there was a time. There was a time you're going someplace, you're probably alone, and you're thinking, I wonder if I'm going to find a parking place. And you think, well, I'm just going to try it. And so you go do what you do. And there you are sitting at the light, it's red, and you want to park in the next block, and everybody's looking for a parking place, and you're best you can, you're holding in your mind, you're going to, you know, whatever you do. Light turns green, you start across the way, start across the intersection, and as you're starting down the road, somebody comes running from the building, and you think, maybe. And so you slow down, and sure enough, they get in their car, and they pull out, and you pull in, and part of you goes, ha! This stuff works! That's what unity is about. Using these principles on something that's important to you. When you do that, and it happens, not only do you get that experience, wow, it worked, the next want comes up. The next desire. I love the word desire. It means sired of God. What Jesus said is use the principles on that. That's what he was talking about, pray unceasingly. I don't think it was, you know, one of these kinds of things. I mean, use these principles unceasingly. And so the next want comes up. Use the principles on that. And when that happens again, you get that experience. Wow, it happened again. You know what I'm talking about. Next want comes up. Use the principles on that. About the third or fourth time in a row that you use these principles on something that's important to you and it happens, about the third or fourth time in a row that it works, there's a shift in the mind. And the shift in the mind is sort of like, I'm on a hot streak. Or, everything's working together for good in my life. And I don't mean that as an affirmation when your life's going down the toilet. You get an experience of that. Whoa, it's all working. That's where most of us quit using the tools. I submit to you what Charles and Myrtle brought to this party, what Jesus brought to the human race. Use these principles even when you're on a hot streak. Even when things are going good, use the principles. And as you continue to do that, I think what happens is you move into what I call the state of grace. The state of grace, knowing that everything is perfect. And I don't mean in an abstract way. I mean you get an experience of it. And it can be difficult to continue to use these principles on your priorities in the state of grace, because there's so many authors that say you need to leave your priorities at the door. Jesus never said that. Jesus never said God's got a plan for you. Jesus never said let go and let God. Jesus never said give up your attachment to the outcome. Other teachers did, but he never did. You continue to use these principles on your priorities. And you, as you move through even the state of grace, there will come a time in your life where you have to stop and ask, who must I be? Who must I be for my life to be this magnificent? And the answer is my beloved daughter, in whom I'm well pleased, my beloved son. We get an experience of our relationship with God through the quality of our human existence. That's what Jesus brought to the human race. He didn't bring how to have an out-of-body experience of being one with God. Jesus brought how to use these principles so you have an in-body experience of being one with God. That's what this center offers you. This is about you making your dreams come true. I can remember when I used to look in the mirror at this body and almost throw up because of all the holes and the pus coming out and two, you know. Now I look at in the mirror at this marvelous body. I don't have a colostomy anymore. I don't have that infection because I healed my body. Sometimes people come to me and they say, don't you mean God healed your body? I look them right in the eye and say, no, I don't. My God didn't make me sick, and my God didn't make me well. My God simply communicated, I adore you just the way that you are, and you pick the game, and I will play with you there. I'm not here to challenge your beliefs. Of course your beliefs are true. You can prove they're true. You got books that prove they're true. You got other people who think like you. But what I would ask you is, do your current beliefs support you in having the kind of life you want? Because what Jesus brought to the human race was you have the right and the authority to use divine power to create what you want. And this isn't new with me. This is what Charles Fillmore is talking about. It gets buried sometimes in all the dogma and different stuff. On page 71 of the Unity Treasure Chest, Charles Fillmore is talking about how do we start? How do we start in this game of creating a life that's full of joy? How do we start in this creating this life that's full of abundance? And he says this. The way to do this is the way Jesus did it. He acknowledged himself to be the Son of God. The attainment of Christ consciousness calls for nothing less on our part than a definite recognition of ourselves as the sons and daughters of God, right here, right now, regardless of appearances to the contrary. Amen. That's what he's talking about when Jesus said, know the truth and it shall set you free. What is the truth? Your unique expression of the divine spirit. I call that the living Christ. It is not the Christ within you that's the hope and the glory. It's the Christ you are that's the hope and the glory. And then Charles Fillmore moves on to page 98 in the Unity Treasure Chest, and he says, once you understand the truth of your existence, you move into creating the life you want with authority. Because he says, Jesus did not claim to have exclusive use of the supernatural power he used. And that's just how he languaged it back in the 1800s, the supernatural power. He knew that others could do what he did if they would only try. And he encouraged his followers to use the power of faith and thought. For after all, it was our brother who said, the works that I do shall ye do also, and even greater works than these shall ye do. What are your dreams? What are your aspirations? Or do you even know anymore? Are you so busy giving up your attachment to the outgoing, letting go of this and holding your palms up and putting zeros on a dollar bill that you forgot what your priorities are? You're God expressing uniquely as a woman. God expressing uniquely as a man. That is the truth that sets you free. And what does it set you free from? The lie of human limitations. The lie of human limitations. It can be challenging to internalize these principles. It can be challenging to figure out, how do I use them? How does it work for me? It took me a long time to get well. Even after I got rid of the infection, it took a long time for me to clear my body of pain and the residual effect from all that. But I was fortunate. I had teachers like you do. I had teachers like Shanna, not her personally, but teachers like her who empowered me to continue to look towards what I did want instead of always dealing with what I don't want. What this center offers you is the opportunity to study and practice spiritual principles that have been around for thousands of years. And the whole purpose of this community is to assist you to understand your power, to understand your authority. I encourage you to get involved, because I think owning these principles is more than just coming to church on Sunday. And that's why you have so many opportunities. There are board openings that are open now for you to get on the board. It can be challenging, it takes time, but when you get involved in this community, what happens is you make these ideas part of the fabric of your existence. You can get in the chaplain's program. You can be a volunteer. I encourage you to get involved in this center, because this center is an answer to your dream. It's an answer to your prayer. Where else are you going to sit around and talk about the possibility of being the Christ? You're going to do it at your family, you know, thing that you had at Thanksgiving? What do you think would happen if you stood up in front of your family and said, "You know what I learned this week? I'm the living Christ." Get involved in this center, and what it will do is assist you to use these principles so you can make your dreams come true. You're magnificent. You're powerful. And it's an honor for me to stand in your presence. God bless. Thanks, sir. Thank you.